everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 115. My name is Charles Lowell, this episode's host and a developer here at the Frontside. And with me today to talk some shop is Mr. Will Wilsman.
Hello.
Hello, Will.
How's it going?
It's going good. It's going good. I'm actually pretty excited to get to jump into this topic because we're going to be talking about some of the big things that are happening at Frontside and some of the things that we've been developing, gosh, almost for the last year.
It's been about a year,
and we've talked about it in various podcasts, but we're going to be talking about it again because there's just been so much progress that we've made, and I think a lot of clarity in kind of what we're going for here when we talk about big test and testing big and how, you know, we want to roll out the big test framework, and you know, we just have a lot more experience using it on a number of different projects. So we're going to get to talk about that today. So before we get started, I just wanted to talk a little bit about what big test is, both in terms of the framework and also the philosophy. So, I mean, Will, you've been, you know, you're the one who works the most on big test. What when you think about, like, philosophically, what does big test mean to you?
Like, there's the size of your tests, not a physical size or like a size in storage, but just like how much your test actually does. And like the test itself can be very small, as our tests are, but it tests the whole application from like the user interacting with it down to like the network requests. And yeah, so that's the definition, the philosophy of a big test to me, is it tests your application, you know, from the biggest point of view.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, actually achieving that can be surprisingly difficult, especially in, you know, a front-end JavaScript application. And there are a lot of solutions out there for testing, and we've talked about them. So one of the questions that arises is, like, what is, when we talk about big test, what exactly are we talking about? Are we talking about a product that you can download and install? Are we talking about the philosophy that you just outlined? Or are we talking about the individual pieces of software that, like, make that philosophy real? And I think the answer is we're kind of talking about all three, but we wanted to take this episode to talk about, like, where we're going with the product, and then how we're going, like, what we've identified as the subcomponent pieces of that product. In other words, in order to get started testing big, what are the things that you need to think about? What are the things that you need to do? And then what are, like, the component pieces? Because one of the things that I think is very important to us is that you be able to arrive at wherever you are in your project, whatever framework you're using, whatever current testing solution, and be able to begin using big test. And so that means you might be using some of it, or you might be using a lot of it, but, you know, we want to meet you exactly where you are so that you can then get onboarded and, you know, start testing big. So,
yeah, that's definitely an important distinction that we get confusion about, is like, what is big test? And people just assume like this whole test suite is big test, but we use the parts of it ourselves. Like, we use Mocha, which is not part of big test. You know, we use Chai, which is not part of big test. We use Mirage, which is kind of part of big test, but definitely didn't originate in big test, and Karma and things like that. So big test isn't, you know, your testing suite. It's not one thing to go to grab to start writing tests. It's small pieces that you can use in conjunction with other small pieces to just make it really easy and flexible to test your application.
Exactly. And so, because it turns out that there's a lot going on in the application, you know, maybe we should kind of talk about what some of those pieces are that you might, you know, want to start using big test with, or that you might need to test big, I guess I should say. What's a good place to start? Let's start with talking about some of the issues that you want to do when you're testing big. And then we can talk about, you know, what pieces of the testing story then fit in to solve those issues. One of them is, you know, you need to test that your application works, like actually works. And so that means you need to be able to test on a multiplicity of browsers. For example, we're limiting to the domain of web applications. There are actually a shockingly large number of browsers, right? You know, it's not just Chrome. Yeah. It's not just Safari. There's mobile Chrome, mobile Safari, which are subtly different. There's edge. And I'm sure the mobile edge is slightly different too.
Yeah.
So you want to be able to test cross browser, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, things like Nightmare and JS DOM and things with simulated browsers, we don't necessarily, you know, think those are the best tools for writing big tests, because we want to ensure that, like, those browser quirks are caught and tested as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not, I mean, this is not theoretical. Like, sometimes you'll have a syntax, like the parser is slightly different, and you'll have something that throws a syntax error in Safari or in Internet Explorer, and your whole app is completely just busted. And if you just taken the time just to even try and load the app in that browser, you would have caught that.
Yeah,
that's like, one that I've been bitten on many times.
Yeah, and one I just saw come up yesterday, which comes up frequently, is not closing your selector, like your CSS selector. Mm-hmm. And Chrome doesn't really care, like WebKit browsers don't care too much. But yeah, that'll fail in Edge, and depending on what you're missing in the selector, it'll fail in Safari too. But mostly, like, Firefox and Chrome don't care about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it seems like the majority of testing solutions are kind of focused around headless Chrome, you know, or some variation of Electron. Mm-hmm. And that entire class of, like, really, like, dumb errors, right, is aren't even caught. And, you know, like I said, to actually catch it all, you know, it takes like less than a millisecond of CPU time just to load it onto the browser and see that thing doesn't work. And unfortunately they can be like catastrophic errors. But the problem is, how do you actually do? So we want to test like cross browser, right? This is something that we want to do with, for me, it's, you know, I just can't imagine shipping an application without having some form of cross-browser testing, some capability of being able to say, I want to test it. Like, we want it to work on these 8 browsers, and so we're going to test it on these 8 browsers. How do you actually go about doing that?
Yeah, so right now we're working on, you know, the big test CLI, which will help us launch browsers, but that's not complete yet. It has some bugs, so in the meantime, we've been using Karma, which is great. And basically you just have this service that's able to find the browser binaries on the system and just launch them, point them to localhost with your app loaded up, and, you know, let your normal, you know, development server take care of loading the tests up and running the tests.
Mm-hmm.
And Karma and the Big Test CLI is just there to capture output and launch those separate browsers.
Yeah. I remember it being very, like, when I was first working with Karma, and I think Testem is another tool that's in this space. So we kind of, there's Testem, Karma, and then Big Test actually is, we're developing a launcher, because launching is something that you're going to need. But it's actually, it's such a weird problem. I feel like with the browser launchers, there's like 3 levels of inversion of control. Cause like, you're starting a server that then starts another process, which then calls back to your server, which then loads the app resources, which then loads the tests, and then runs the tests. So there's a lot of sleight of hand that has to happen. And
including like injecting the adapter that you use, mm-hmm. like the Mocha adapter, the Jasmine adapter, that ends up reporting back to the CLI. Like, that's something Karma and Testem and Big Test CLI will handle for you.
Right. So you're fanning out the test suite to a suite of browsers and then collecting the results. But you need some sort of agent living inside the browser that's going to act on behalf of the test suite to collect the results. And I remember when I first came into contact with Karma and Testem, I was like, this is so unnecessarily complex. But then I think, having used it for a while, and then I still think there is some complexity that can be removed, but it's kind of, if you want to do cross-browser testing, that kind of level of ping-ponging is just, there's a certain amount of it that's just necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that's actually quite complex that you need to have in your stack, in your toolbox, if you want to test, if you want to truly test big.
Yeah, in all these solutions is like mechanisms for detecting when the browser has launched and restarting the browser based on its like health check, et cetera, things like that, that, you know, you wouldn't think of actually loading up a browser, but you need to think of when you're doing automated testing.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that sets apart, for example, the launcher solution? So like, we kind of call this class of solutions launchers. So Testem, Karma, the Big Test CLI. What is it that sets Big Test CLI apart from, say, Karma and Testem?
We're trying to be as minimal config as possible and just really easy to get started and going. And so Karma, there's a lot of plugins that you need to make sure you have installed and loaded and the options set for those plugins. And TestM has some stuff bundled, but it still requires like this big config ball at the beginning that you need to pass it in order to tell it what you're doing. And so we're trying to avoid that with Big Test CLI. And one of the ways that we're able to avoid that is by just letting your bundler handle bundling the test. Like the Karma, you need like Karma Webpack or something. TestM has some stuff that it needs. And really, we just want, you know, change your, like in testing mode, when you're in the testing environment, just change your index to point to your tests instead of your application. And your bundler will do all the work. And we just serve that file and collect the results.
Right. So it doesn't matter if you're using Parcel or you're using Webpack or you're using Ember CLI.
Or roll up even
just like low level Broccoli or something, or Gulp or whatever. There's a preponderance of bundling solutions. And that was always something that was just a huge pain in the butt with Karma. I know it's like just getting to the point where my tests are loaded. And you look at kind of with TestM, most of my experience with TestM comes through how it's used in Ember CLI and like the histrionics that, you know, are undertaken just to bundle all your test assets and your application assets and your vendor assets and like, you know, just kind of bootstrap that thing. It's a lot of work.
Another thing Big Test CLI like doesn't include that Karma and TestM does is the concept of a watcher, because all these bundlers, like you have HMR, hot module reloading, you know, roll up and things like that come with plenty of plugins. Parcel does all this out of the box. So if you're using your bundler, your existing bundler to bundle your tests, you get that watch feature kind of for free.
So that's why we implement it.
Yeah, that's another complexity that the Big Test CLI kind of eliminates.
So there is, what it means is we've hidden most of that complexity. Just let the bundler handle it, right? The bundler is the part of your project that bundles.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have your launcher actually doing that for you. But we still do need to have, you know, some way to do that setup and teardown. So when we have that testing endpoint, you know, we have some way to say, okay, we're starting a test, mount the application, we're ending the test, tear it down. And so how do you abstract that away?
Yeah, so that's kind of something that we can't really avoid, is just like some sort of dependency on the framework itself, your application framework. So like you need to mount a React app and you need to mount an Ember app, et cetera. And there's different ways to mount those things. So this is, you know, one of the things that can't really be decoupled as much as everything else can. But yeah, Big Test has Big Test React and Big Test Vue. And we want to eventually get to like Big Test Ember. But really the main export of all these packages is just a simple mount helper that will, you know, mount and clean up your application for you in your testing hooks, whether you're using Before Each from Mocha or, you know, Before from something else like Jasmine or Jest. You know, no matter what you're doing, you just have a hook that mounts your application and then cleans it up on the next mount.
Yep. And it's worth pointing out here that we actually, you know, this is kind of a core concern of testing and testing big, is being able to mount your application and tear it down with regularity and having hooks into that process. And whether you're using Big Test or whether you're not, can you still use Big Test React and Big Test Vue, even if you weren't using anything else about Big Test?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, they just export simple mount helpers. I don't even think they have any other inner Big Test dependencies. Yeah, they just have peer dependencies on, you know, their frameworks, you know.
Right. And so you could use it if you wanted to roll everything else by hand, or you wanted to get started somehow and you needed to do setup and teardown. You know, again, this is something that's key to being able to test big. So you should be able to use it independently, whether you're using the CLI or not, whether you're using any of the other tools or not. You know, all of the tools can be used independently.
And another feature of the Big Test React and Big Test Vue is the teardown that happens before setup, rather than happening after your test runs, having a separate teardown. This allows it where whether your test passes or fails, you can look at it and play with it and inspect it and debug it much easier than if you had teardown, you had to disable that teardown or throw a pause in there.
Yeah.
Or a debugger or something.
Yeah, I love that. So just this is when something goes wrong, you just can just let the test case run. And it, the last test that it runs, it just leaves it set up.
Yep.
Right. It does the teardown right before the setup.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
at the very end of the whole test run, there's an app there waiting for you to play with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so if you focus in on a single test, you know, we most commonly use Mocha. So you say it.only to run that single focus test. Then you have the state of the application at that test case set up and ready to go. And you can just play with it. You can inspect it. You can actually just use it as a starting off point and, you know, interact with the app normally as you would.
Yeah, I want to say that Cypress does this too. They do their teardown before their setup as well. And that's how you're able to play with Cypress tests.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like that. I like that trick. Now we talked about, launching, setup and teardown, but we haven't actually talked about much of the what actually happens in the test cases themselves. So we talked about, you know, how to start and launch your test suite, how to do that across a bunch of different browsers, how inside of that you need, you know, have a kind of a separate concern is application setup and teardown, and you how you want to lean on how your actual app is actually bundled, right? Because that fits in with the philosophy of testing big. You don't want to use a external bundler for your test suite. You want to use your real bundler. How are the assets actually going to look? But when it comes down to actually writing the tests, you need to be able to interact with at a highest level as you possibly can. So when I say highest level, I mean, we want to verify that the users, when they do take certain actions, will see certain outcomes. And so, you know, we want those outcomes, and we already talked about this, to be reflected in a real DOM, in a real browser. But at the same time, the real interactions, we want those to be as high fidelity as possible. So you want to be sending events, you know, to the browser. You want to be, you know, real mouse events, real key events, real interactions.
So interacting with the application. Yeah, that's another core philosophy that we kind of talked about earlier that defines a big test is, you know, the user interacting with your application. We're not calling methods and expecting other callbacks or arguments to be passed. We're clicking on a button and expecting, you know, a message to pop up that says form submitted successfully. You know, these are user facing things we're asserting on and acting on.
Yeah. And it can be really tricky, right? Because these things don't happen synchronously. They're happening inside of your browser's event loop, right? I click that button and then, you know, it goes off and there's some loading state. And then I might get an error message that pops up this thing that animates out and then goes away. And so, you know, the state of the browser is in constant flux. It's constantly changing. And so it can be very difficult to put your finger and say, I want it to be in this state. I want it to be this state. If you are limiting yourself to only reading from the DOM, right? Some frameworks, you know, I know Ember, for example, you have kind of a white box where you can actually inspect, you know, the state of the Ember run loop and use that to do some synchronization. But, you know, it can be very hard to coordinate these interactions.
Yeah. And, you know, to talk about getting to the solution is a, you know, Big Test Interactor, which is a basically modern page components or page objects. If you've ever heard of page objects, it's just a way to encapsulate interacting with, you know, big pieces of your pages. And it's not a new concept. It's been around for a while, but Big Test Interactor is kind of a new twist on it, where they're immutable, composable interactions that are also convergent, which we'll get into later, which basically means if your button's not there, it won't click the button until it is there.
Right.
So they're really powerful and make it really easy and fun to write these tests.
Yeah, they're super powerful. And I remember we talked about convergences last time we talked about big tests, but interactors, I think, are definitely a new development. And I think we should spend a little bit of time there talking about not just the power, but also the ergonomics of interactors, because they are like page components or page objects, except they're scoped to the component. So not only do they have, you know, all this wonderful stuff where it'll make sure that the component exists before it starts to interact with it and things like that, but they're composable, right? It's like if I have a button, then there are certain operations that are valid for that button. I can click it. I can hover over it. I can do all these things. There are the operations that make it unique to the button. Now, those might actually map to real events.
Similarly, there are assertions about that button as well, like is primary, is secondary. You know, if this button is repeated throughout your application, you might want to make sure that, you know, your form has a primary and secondary button.
Exactly. So it really encapsulates all the knowledge of how you can interact with both in terms of taking action and reading state from that button. And it almost feels like an accessibility API, right? Like it would be easy to write a screen reader if you had, you know, these interactors for every single component on the page.
That's kind of what it is. It's just like you're defining an API around how your user would interact with your application and what your user would expect from the application. That's the point of page objects and interactors, is you're defining this user API, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so really the step that interactors take is that they take the classic page object and they just make them composable. So I can have a... You know, you kind of touched on this before. I can have a modal dialogue interactor, which is composed out of two button interactors, one for like the primary action, one for the secondary action, and maybe it's aware of its own title text. So you can assert on the title text, but I didn't actually have to write the individual button interactors for that modal dialogue interactor. And then I might have a second modal dialogue interactor that's, or a form that's on a modal dialogue that's composed of, you know, the modal dialogue direct interactors and the individual form components which appear on that particular modal dialogue.
It's essentially how we've been building applications lately with components, but this is for page objects in your tests. You know, we want to mirror that. So yeah, you basically, like, you don't have to have one-to-one mappings of an interactor to a component, but if you do, it's really powerful.
Yeah, I found that when we have one-to-one interactors, that's when it just feels the best.
Yeah. And on top of this, if you have a component library and your component library exports the interactors that it uses for the component test, because like we said, these big test technologies, they're sprinklable. So, you know, we don't have to use interactors in big acceptance tests. We can use them in smaller component tests too. Mm-hmm. So if we ship these component interactors with the component library, your application that's consuming this component library now can test those components for free without having to write their own interactors. They can just compose the interactors exported by the library.
Man, I almost want you to repeat that like word for word again, just so it can sink in. Like this is, it's so awesome. Like, because it makes your, when you actually go to write your tests, you're not starting from ground zero. Like, how do I do this? They're like, oh, I'm writing some tests for this thing and I'm using these components. And so I've already got the prepackaged interactions for those components. And so you, it's like you start writing your tests. If, you know, your tests are, you know, a 10-story building, it's like you're starting on, you know, floor 7. And you only have to walk up to floor 10 instead of slogging up all 10 stories.
Yeah. And one really helpful interactor that we work with in the open source stuff we've been working on is a date picker interactor, because date pickers can be really complex. And so just having that common interactor, and we have a date picker on multiple forms where we can just, you know, use that one interactor. We don't have to tell every single test how to interact with that date picker. We just say, you know, pick date and pass it a date.
Yeah, no, it's so awesome. And like that is actually a great example, right? It doesn't feel scary to write a test for a page that has a date picker on it. Or two, if you're doing like a date range or something like that, you're like, oh my God, I don't want to write the selectors to test this. It's like, no, you just import your date picker interactor. You set the date. It actually worries about all the low level events and boom, boom, boom. And there you go. It feels like you're operating at a much higher level.
Yeah. And like your interactor API is essentially like you're telling the test what the user would be doing and what the user would be seeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's worth pointing out again. So, you know, we've identified starting and launching, we've identified setup and teardown, but like interaction is a core concern of testing, of big testing, whether you're doing it, no matter which tool you're using. And so one of the things that we found is interactors are something that you can sprinkle on literally any test suite if you're testing an interface, and it makes it better. Like we've used it inside big acceptance tests. We've used it inside Jest, doing just little component tests. There are people in the big test community who have used it, you know, to write basically write component tests against a JS DOM. And even, you know, like while theoretically, philosophically, you want to make those tests as big as you possibly can, it's still, you know, you can use that piece of in your test suite, right? So if you are using a simulated DOM and you are using not, if you're running in Node in a browser, these interactors will still work and you're going to get high fidelity test cases that are resilient to this asynchrony and are composable and that other people can use in, you know, if they do have a full-fledged test suite, they can, you know, you can reuse these interactors. Like they are a really awesome power up that you can bring into your test suite.
And they are not tied to the framework at all. So, you know, we use them in React for our stuff, but we've also written some in Ember and, you know, Robert's written some in Vue and ported some tests. And one of the beautiful things we've seen from this is that, you know, that one interactor goes everywhere. Like you just write the interactor once and you can use it in Ember, in React, in Vue, and in those test suites. So if the rest of your test suite is also framework agnostic, you have this test suite that you can jump frameworks and your test suite still works and can test your application with high fidelity.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is it's fantastic. And I remember when we first tried using like interactors inside an Ember test suite, right? Because Ember comes with like a big kitchen sink testing setup, but you know, interactors just slotted right in and like there was absolutely no issue.
Yeah, and there's actually a speed boost even because most of the Ember test helpers are hooked into the Ember run loop and interactors are not. And so there was actually a good speed boost just using interactors.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually, so this is a good point because it's a good segue because typically we think of acceptance tests as being really slow. And one of the reasons even that people eschew acceptance tests or testing big is they think like it's going to take a long time. And, you know, we found that actually we've been able to maintain a happy medium of testing big, but also having those tests be really, really fast. When you said a speed boost from using interactors with Ember, where does that speed boost actually come from?
So I mentioned that, you know, the Ember test helpers are hooked into the Ember run loop and interactors aren't. And the reason that is because interactors are convergent and they wait for things in the DOM to exist before interacting with them. So instead of waiting for the framework to settle, it just waits for the thing to appear and then it interacts with it immediately. Mm-hmm. Like if you're asserting something about a button toward the top of the page, you don't really care that another button at the bottom of the page has rendered yet. Unless, of course, you have an assertion about that, but if they're convergent, you don't need to hook into the run loop to wait for the entire page to load to interact with just one piece of it.
Right. You're just waiting to say, okay, I'm expecting something to happen, and the moment I detect it, no matter what else is going on, you know, the page could be taking 30 seconds to load, but if that button appears and I can interact with it, that's all. Like I can take my action then, or I can make my assertion then. So it's about kind of removing gates, artificial gates.
Yeah. Another common thing this helps with is like animations. Is most tests that are hooked into the run loop, you kind of have to wait for some of these animations to finish before you can even interact with the element. And that means if a modal has, you know, a half second animation where it flies in and then you have 30 tests around this modal, those tests are extremely slow now because you have to wait for that modal to come in.
Straight up flaky.
Whereas in the actual DOM, you know, that modal is inserted pretty immediately and can be interacted with pretty immediately. And so interactors, they don't need to wait for that animation to finish. They can just immediately, you know, interact with that modal. But of course, if you need to wait for that animation to finish, there are options for that as well.
Yeah. I mean, you can just basically make sure that it's, you know, if there's some fade in that needs to happen, I mean, you can kind of assert on any state. And as long as it's achieved at some point, the interactor will recognize it and recognize it at the soonest possible time that it possibly could. I remember getting bitten on one project where, you know, the modal animations in particular were so brutal. Not only were they flaky, they just were slow because there was all these manual timeouts and it was just a constant source of, you know, it was like, it wasn't even a paper cut. It was like kind of like a knife cut. Like it wasn't, it's like there's someone sitting there, you're kind of slashing you with a pocket knife. It just was a constant source of pain in your side.
Yeah. And that's when you end up, or that's how you end up with things like waits and sleeps in your test suite when you need to wait for that animation to happen or something. And you just see a sleep of 4 seconds with a comment that says we have to wait for the component to load in. That's kind of a code smell. So.
Yeah. That's just asking for trouble, both in terms of slowness and in terms of it's going to get flaky again. Yeah. And so that's actually one of the things that has been kind of one of the most freeing things about working with interactors and working with convergent assertions on which they're based is you just don't ever have to worry about asynchrony. I mean, for really, truly, like most of the time you're writing your tests, like it's all synchronous. Right. Yeah. And that kind of makes sense because from the user's perspective, their consciousness is synchronous. Right. And they don't care about the internal of the run loop. It's just they're making observations in serial. And, at some point they're going to observe something. And so, the interactor sits at that point and really observes the application the way that your user would.
Yeah. And we've mentioned a few times now already, like the convergent assertions, which interactors are based on. And there's a little caveat there where if you're using interactors and you're making, non-convergent assertions, they might fail or be flaky. That's because, interactors wait for the thing to be there to interact with. So mm-hmm. as soon as the button's there, it clicks it, but it doesn't wait for after that event has fired and your application has reacted to that event. That's, your application's concern. So we need something there, like our convergent assertions that can, converge on that state and wait for that state to be true before it considers itself passing or, mm-hmm. it times out.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things, I think when it comes, maybe we should dig a little bit into convergent assertions, because this is kind of, I think the last time we had a public conversation on the podcast about this, this is kind of where we were. Like we hadn't built the interactors. We hadn't built these other component pieces of the testing story. We were really focused on the convergent assertion. So we've talked a little bit about this, but I think it's worth rehashing a little bit because it's a unique way of approaching the system, but it's also kind of horrifying when you see how it works under the covers. Like, I think when we tell people about the fact that it's basically polling underneath the covers, the timeout is configurable, right? But it's basically polling every 10 milliseconds to observe a state. And like, I remember the first time being confronted with this idea, I was like horrified. My programmer hackles on the back of my neck, like raised up. And I was like, wait, this is going to be slow. It's going to be computationally intensive.
Yeah, that was my exact thought too, is this is going to be slow. If acceptance tests are slow and we're doing an acceptance test every 10 milliseconds, that's going to be really slow. And that's actually not the case completely. It's
right.
It's actually the opposite. They're extremely fast.
It is like shockingly fast. Like you've got to try it to believe how fast it is, how fast you can run acceptance tests. And so
talking like 100 tests in like just tens of seconds.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're basically gated by how fast your framework can render.
Yeah.
Right. Your tests are not part of the slowness. Mm-hmm. Your tests.
And also memory leaks can cause slowness too. So we experienced that recently where we had memory leaks that were slowing down our tests, but fix those up and the test sped right back up.
Yeah. Because basically, you're just trying to, actually running the assertion or running the convergence is very fast. It's just a very light ping. It's like, I kind of think of it as, it's as light as the brush of a photon or something when it's bouncing off of a surface so that you can observe it. I mean, it really is, it's extremely light. And most of the time it's just waiting. So the test and the convergence really just gets out of the way, right? Because, they're lightweight, just because they can run, 1,000 times or 100 times in a second, it doesn't gum it up. But the thing that really is, it means that your tests run as fast as your application will run. You get back to the point, what was it in React where the kind of the key insight is that, JavaScript is not the bottleneck. Well, your tests are not the bottleneck.
Yeah.
I guess is what it is. And before, so I don't know if there's anything else that you want to say about convergences.
No, we pretty much summed it up there. I mean, that's what interactors are based on. That's how they're able to wait for things in the DOM is basically it just pulls the DOM until it exists, and then it moves on and actually does the interaction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so once again, this is actually a very low level thing on which Big Test is based, but this is once again, something that you can use independently. You can write your own convergent assertions. You can write your own convergences that honestly have nothing to do with testing or assertions. I mean, it's a freestanding library you can use in your test suite or elsewhere, should you choose.
And there doesn't need to be DOM for a Big Test convergence either. Like I use Big Test convergence in Big Test CLI to converge on the browser being launched. So mm-hmm. instead of, you know, waiting for the browser to report that, I can just kind of pull and see how that process is doing. And convergence waits for that process to start before moving on.
Right. I guess the best way I've thought about it, it's a way to synchronize on observations and not on callbacks, right? So it's a synchronization mechanism, and 99% of the synchronization mechanisms that we're used to, they've involved some sort of callback, a promise, you know, an event listener, things like that, where it's like, or, you know, even a generator, where control is handed back explicitly to a piece of code when something happens, you know, whereas this is a fundamentally different synchronization primitive where you are writing synchronous code that's based on observations. So when I mm-hmm. observe this, do this. When I observe this, do this. So it's extremely robust.
Yeah, very.
So I don't know if that's – well, it is a core piece. It's a fundamental thing that on which interactors are based, on which the CLI is based. I don't know if it's core to writing tests, but
it definitely helps.
It definitely helps. It definitely helps. We couldn't have Big Test Interactor without that.
No, definitely not.
Because that's what makes it fast. That's what makes it not flaky at all. And I, you know, having those things, I think, makes it easy to maintain, because your tests can, you can work at the interactor level or the level of user interaction, and you don't have to worry about synchronization. So your, the flow of your tests are very natural.
Yeah. Like, we don't have to explicitly wait for a request to be done before making an assertion about your app. That'll just mm-hmm. come with convergences, just waiting for that state in your application to be true.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about one more piece of the testing issue. Because when you're testing big, when you're testing in the browser, there's always the issue of what are you going to do about your API, right? You've mm-hmm. got to have your API running. And if you're using, well, it's just always an issue. And this is kind of interesting, because this sits at the crossroads of testing big and also getting the most utility out of your tests. Because in an ideal world, right, you would be, if you're testing really big, you're going to be using a real API.
Yeah.
You're not going to poke holes in reality.
Yeah. That's kind of one of the things that we avoid in big tests, is poking holes. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not shallow mounting the components and testing the methods and the results. We're fully mounting these things and fully interacting with them through the full DOM API.
Yeah, exactly. And not right, using real browsers. And it just occurred to me the irony of us talking about, you know, reality being things that are still running inside of a computer processor. but I think we inherited this term from that talk that Justin Searles gave at AssertJS in 2017. It's a really, really excellent talk. I think he gave it at RubyConf again, but you know, it's the Don't Mock Me.
Yeah. And it's one of my favorite talks.
Yeah. It's a great talk. And in it, you know, he talks about, you know, the value of a test is, you know, a balance of how many holes you poke in reality. And sometimes you encounter tests where all it is like holes in reality. and you know, whether you're mocking this, you're mocking that, you're mocking the DOM, you're mocking the browser, you're mocking your network layer, you're mocking this external API. And, you know, the more holes you poke, the less useful it's going to be. And so network is one of those where it can be very difficult to not poke holes in that reality, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a huge part of your application, your front end application, is how it's going to interact with the server. But at the same time, you know, servers are gigantic pieces of software themselves, each with their own dependencies, each with their own setup and teardown.
You know, have their own concerns.
Yeah, exactly. They might be in a different language. They've got, you know, runtime things, like they might need external C libraries and crazy stuff like that. And they're their own beast. So to get a true big end-to-end test, you're going to have to stand up your server. But the problem that presents is you want your tests to be also isolatable. So, you know, if you're a developer, I can go to a repo, I can do a, you know, install of my dependencies, and I can run the tests without having to do any external dependencies other than the repository and the language in which I'm working. And so this is one where we kind of have tried to walk the line of not wanting to poke holes in reality, but also have the test be containable to the actual application. And so in order to do that, you need something that presents a high fidelity version of the network. So you can kind of try and have your cake and eat it too, right? Like you want to have something that acts like a server and really acts like a server, but it's actually not a server.
And yeah, and still poke as few holes as possible in, you know, the application and how that's all set up. Like, we don't want to be intercepting methods and responding with fake data. That's not a good way to mock that network.
Right. We want to be making actual, calling actual fetches, calling actual XML HTTP requests. Ideally, if you've got service workers, making actual service worker requests. Things like that.
Basically, as far as the application is concerned, it's talking to a real server for all it knows.
Yeah. And that's kind of the litmus test for, is it a hole in reality or is it just a really great illusion?
Yeah, and that's a good name for Mirage, right? It's a really great illusion.
Yeah. So it is a simulation of reality. And so we use Mirage, which is something from the Ember testing world, but something that we have extracted and made available as Big Test Mirage.
Yeah, so the main difference just being that, you know, we've taken away the Ember dependencies and the run loop stuff. And it's just a plain JavaScript Mirage. You know, it works exactly the same as you would use it in Ember, minus the auto imports and, you know, the file. Oh, man, I can't think of that word right now. Yeah, aside from, like, automatically importing, you know, your files for your server config, you know, you have to do that manually because Ember is what provides that. But other than that, it's a full-on Mirage. You know, you define models and serializers and factories and all the good stuff.
Right. And then you can use those factories and you can use those models to really give a high fidelity server. So if you are building something in whatever framework, you can use Big Test Mirage to simulate that network layer. And again, we've used it in a number of different scenarios. But having that in place means that, you know, you're going to be able to have those high fidelity tests where your application is actually making XML HTTP requests, but it's all isolatable so that it can be run in repo. It also has, this isn't really related to testing, but it has a fantastic capability where you can pre-populate, you can use the factories to pre-populate your server with data so that you can actually, you can use the application without the actual server being implemented.
Yeah, and that's extremely powerful. That's what we were talking about earlier, getting at, is the scenarios, which are setting up, you know, specific, essentially fixtures, but you're generating these fixtures.
Right.
You know, factories are essentially high level fixtures, you know, higher order fixtures.
And
what these scenarios are, just setting up these fixtures for a scenario of your application, say like the backend's down or the list only responds with two items as opposed to 5,000 items, you know, something like that. You want to be able to not only test these things, but be able to develop against it. Mm-hmm. And Mirage makes that really easy. You can just start your app with Mirage enabled, point to that scenario, and you're there. You have that exact scenario to develop in.
Yeah. If you've never used Mirage, it is really hard to understand just how incredibly powerful it can be. Like, we've used it now on at least 4 projects where we did develop the entire, you know, first version of the product without any back end whatsoever. It's an incredible product development tool, even apart from testing. So, I mean, that then informs the shape of what the API was going to be. I mean, I know we've talked about this on the podcast before, but it's really an incredible technology, and it is available to you no matter what framework you're using. It's I think it's one of the best kept secrets in JavaScript development.
Yeah, it's definitely great. But that said, though, it does have some fallacies. Like, it's great, but it can be a little slow sometimes. So mm-hmm. We are eventually working on a big test network, like another piece of the big test pie that you'll be able to sprinkle into your application.
Right.
But in the meantime, praise Mirage.
Yeah. No, we are going to be offering an alternative, or, you know, maybe collaborating for another version of Mirage. But, you know, hopefully we can make Mirage faster, or we'll be able to make this thing faster so that it can use service workers and be used in a bunch of different scenarios.
Yeah.
So just to recap, you know, we've talked about a lot of different components, but these are over the past couple years, these are the things that we've identified as being really key components as being part of your acceptance testing and really your testing stack, right? How are you going to start and launch these things? How are you going to set them up and tear them down? How are you going to interact with the application from a user, both in terms of making assertions and how are you going to take action on behalf of the user and still have it be maintainable, have it be resistant to flakiness, have it be performant. And so, you know, big test is the answer to that for those particular areas of the testing story. And so some we're using existing components. We use Karma, we use Mirage today. Those we did not develop. But those where we see kind of key pieces of that puzzle missing is where, you know, we've started writing the big test solutions. So things like the interactor. And, you know, eventually we are going to make big test into a product that's you're going to be able to use kind of out of the box. You know, just like you might install Cypress, where it's, you know, a very quick setup and we make all of the decisions about the components for you. But in the meantime, you know, we're really trying to take our time, identify those pieces of the puzzle, and build the software component that fits that piece of the puzzle the absolute best. And when those are polished, use them in a more comprehensive product. So things like convergence, things like interactor, things like, you know, big test React, big test Vue, and very soon big test Ember. These are things that you're going to be able to use that you can use today to make your tests just that much bigger and that much better, especially interactor. And so, you know, it's been an incredible journey this past year as we've kind of developed these individual pieces. And I mean, there's just going to be more goodness to come.
Absolutely. I mean, right now I'm working on some validation type API for Interactor that I'm hoping to land soon. Mm-hmm. That'll open up the possibilities of, you know, maybe hiding away those convergent assertions a bit more in your tests and just handling those automatically. It'll be pretty good.
Yeah, no, it's really exciting that writing tests has gotten more and more easy and more fun over the last year for us. And I think we were already starting in a pretty good place. So, yeah. So if you have any questions about Big Test, how would folks get in touch with us?
We have a Big Test Gitter channel. You can find a link to that on the Big Test website, bigtestjs.io. And yeah, just ask us questions in Gitter and we'll try to answer them.
Mm-hmm. And as always, you can ask us directly. You can send email to contact@frontside.io or reach out to us on Twitter @thefrontside, or you can actually reach out to the Big Test JS Twitter account directly, and just call us out on Twitter at BigTestJS. So thank you very much, Will.
Thank you, Charles.